From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. This week, I wanted to play for you some of our favorite segments over the past year. Ramadan is underway, so first up is my interview with Anissa Helou about her book, Feast, Food of the Islamic World.
And the Prophet Muhammad broke his fast every day, supposedly, allegedly, with 3 dates.
The book won a James Beard Award for Best International Cookbook last month. Hi.
Hi, Evan.
You know, it's been really fascinating following you on social media as you've been doing research for this book and then getting the book. It's just gorgeous.
I'm so glad you like it. And it was actually totally fascinating researching the book and writing it. And even though I knew parts of it, it was very fresh to kind of start again with a different angle and to look at it from, you know, a general angle of the food of the Islamic world as against only national dishes.
How much of what we look at and see as being food of the Islamic world is related to the Persian Empire?
Well, a lot of it. There are basically two mother cuisines for that world. One is the Persian Empire and the other is the Ottoman Empire. But the Ottoman Empire actually descends from the Persian Empire. So the mother cuisine is the cuisine of the Persian Empire, which was basically appropriated. I know it's a loaded word, but, you know, the Abbasid caliphs took Persian cooks because they loved the cuisine and they were much more refined than they were and took them everywhere where they invaded and occupied. And then when the Ottoman Empire came along, they developed their own, but the basis being, you know, Persian dishes.
In terms of what you present that aren't breads in this book, how much of it comes from court food or royal food, maybe I should say, as opposed to a tradition of home cooking?
I think there's a good balance between court dishes and home-cooked dishes. There is very little that is basically a restaurant. But, you know, in most of this world, home cooking is much more interesting, basically, and better than in the restaurants. I mean, if you go to Iran, for instance, it's unlikely that you're going to eat consistently well in restaurants. The best food you're going to have will be home-cooked food. Whereas in Lebanon, you would have different dishes at home and really excellent dishes, but you can also have fantastic experiences in restaurants, basically because of the mezze tradition.
I would love to talk to you about bread. The bread chapter, which opens the book, is just an incredible introduction to the variety and the minuscule variation as you go from country to country.
Well, bread is so essential to, I mean, there are two staples in the Muslim world. One is bread and the other is rice. Some countries have both as staples and others have one or the other. And so bread is essential in many countries, like in Lebanon and Syria. Also, it acts as cutlery because they scoop the food with bread. So I felt that it was a very important chapter.
We're in Ramadan right now, and you have a recipe for Ramadan bread that also includes dates, which are important in Ramadan. Could you talk about the date and also that particular bread?
The Prophet Muhammad was born and lived in an oasis where the date was very, very important. It was not only a fruit to be, you know, to sustain, but also bartering because it could be sold and exchanged. And the Prophet Muhammad broke his fast every day, supposedly, allegedly, with 3 dates. And then in Syria and in Lebanon, they make these beautiful type of like brioche bread filled with dates. It's basically a snack, not quite as sweet and not a bread to serve with meals, but to snack on.
The history of bread is often pointed to Egypt and, in fact, the history of yeast and the leavening process. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, apparently it was discovered by chance because the bakeries were near the beer makers and the yeast was in the air and they, you know, they left a piece of dough and it kind of rose and they found that it was much lighter and much nicer to, you know, to eat. So they started developing it like this. And they're still, like in Kashgar in China, they still keep a piece of dough from the previous dough and they, you know, they mix it with the new dough. A lot of the breads are not particularly leavened because flat breads don't need that much leavening. But, you know, you need the dough to ferment to get a good flavor and to get texture as well.
So if you were not on book tour, traveling from place to place, and you were going to create a festive table for breaking the fast at the end of the day, what would you have on it from this book?
I have a particular weakness for a recipe for the whole goat roast that I learned to make in the Emirates, because the marinade is so extraordinary, you know, with rose water and saffron and a whole collection of spices. So I often make that, in Sicily, where I spend a lot of time, I roast baby lamb because I can buy very small lambs. But often I would do it with a shoulder or with a leg. And then the Emirati biryani, which is plain rice that's layered with a very concentrated sauce, spicy sauce as well, made with peppers, tomatoes, and onions. Probably a bread, or I could probably break the fast with mansaf, which is the national dish of Jordan. Lamb that is cooked in yogurt and served over a bed of rice on a flat bread.
There's this marvelous sort of side story in the book all about your search for a camel hump. Is camel a meat that is common in parts of the Islamic world?
It is common enough from the point of view that in Syria or in Morocco there are camel, or in Egypt for that matter, you have camel butchers and you can buy it. But old camel is not particularly good because it's quite tough. You know, my search was for the ultimate camel hump, and from a baby camel. So baby camel is what's precious. And in the Arabian Gulf, you don't buy a camel hump or a camel leg. You buy a whole camel. And I was lucky enough that a friend of mine gave me as a present a whole baby camel.
Could you describe what that meat is like?
It was really tender. First of all, the camel hump, it's a lot of fat. But under that hump, there are two fillets against the spine of the animal, and that bit of meat is very tender and very delicious. And so when I cooked the camel hump for my brother in Dubai, he lives in Dubai, first of all, he thought I was crazy when he saw what I brought into his kitchen. And then when I served it to him with saffron rice, he was surprised how good it was. So it's like a cross between beef and lamb. It's not as strong tasting as lamb, and it's not as meaty as beef.
So the breadth of this book is sort of extraordinary. As you've been traveling with it, have people focused in on one dish or another that you think is going to sort of rise to the top as one that is going to be made and blogged about quite a bit?
I would think that if they're going to concentrate on dishes, they would concentrate on dishes that they're less familiar with, that other cookbooks have not covered. And one area that hasn't been covered much is the Arabian Gulf, particularly in the West. So they might, and there's a whole section in the rice chapter on biryani. So maybe biryani could be the dish that people will search to perfect and make and succeed with.
And the spices, the spice bases for most of these biryanis, what are they like? Are they something in between a curry and something more sweet like ras el hanout from Morocco?
Some are quite heady. You know, like the Arabian spice mix, bzar, is quite heady. I think there's a bit of everything. And some are very, very simple. The Tunisian parat, for instance, is just dried rose petals and cinnamon. It's very fragrant and very light. I mean, I was very interested in having all these spice mixtures because usually people concentrate on one or two. But there are so many and such a variation in the kind of flavor that they impart. You know, if it's very complex, if it's simple, if it's really heady, if it's sweet, if it's spicy, you know. So even in the garam masala, I give like three different versions to kind of change, you know, the flavor marginally, but enough to notice the difference. So probably not so much like a curry, because the curry has, maybe I don't know enough about curry, but it has a strong turmeric presence, whereas these turmeric is present in a lot of them, but they're quite balanced, even if they're heady and strong.
So as I've been watching you live your life from afar, as we do now, I was so intrigued that you decided to create a home for yourself in Sicily. Could you talk a bit about why Sicily, why it feels like such a familiar place for you?
Well, I went to Sicily for the first time 20 years ago, to the eastern part, I think, to a beautiful place south of Noto. And I was so struck by how similar the landscape was to parts of Syria. And of course, it's a very beautiful island and surrounded by the sea. And I was brought up in Beirut, which was a seaside city. These two things kind of appealed very much to me.
That's Anissa Halu. Her James Beard winning cookbook is Feast, Food of the Islamic World. After the break, I'm revisiting my interview with Samin Nosrat about her hit Netflix show, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Samin Nosrat is one of my favorite cooking teachers and people, really. And now she's a global icon for her smash hit Netflix show, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat.
The single most important element to good cooking is salt. When you perfectly season something, it zings in your mouth. I don't really ever follow recipes. So to me, tasting is the only way to know. I start with some, and I taste it, and I decide if I want to add a little bit more.
The show just won a James Beard Award for Best TV Show on Location, and I spoke with her last fall about it.
Buongiorno, Samin.
Buongiorno, Evan.
Come stai?
Sto nerviosa.
Nervosa? So we're on radio. We're not on television, so there's no subtitles. So are you shocked by the reception?
I'm overwhelmed. I wouldn't say shocked. I mean, I'm shocked by the sheer amount of it, I guess, and the fact that it seems to be universally positive and the way that it's landed with people. I mean, I get emails every day. The thanks are overwhelming.
And what are they thanking you for?
All different things. Thanks for getting my kids in the kitchen with me. I mean, the most moving email by far that, like, I wept and then I sent it to everyone at Netflix and they all wept was from a woman who sent it maybe less than 24 hours after the show went up. And she said, it was a very matter-of-fact email. It didn't even have, like, a hello. It just said, I assume you're getting a lot of emails for your fantastic show. No need for a response. I brought my daughter home the other day after 11 days in the psychiatric ward. She was diagnosed with bipolar psychosis. She's essentially bedridden and nonverbal. We're tinkering with her meds. We watched the first two episodes of the show yesterday. This morning, she woke up and made pesto with a mortar and pestle and a homemade pizza. It was everything I could do to keep my tears back. You are a profound light. And then she looked at me and she said, I really like her because even though she's been cooking for 18 years, she doesn't lecture. She asks questions.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, God.
I'm like, yeah,
I felt this family's pain and feelings and joy. And I was like, wow, that a cooking show can do this?
But it's not a cooking show. It's you. And I think what's so interesting about Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, the cooking show, is it shows us how far we've come in order to finally have a regular person who is not manufactured for television, who is themselves 100% and happens to also be unbelievably smart and super accomplished. The fact that you were able to do that, go through the production process, where here in Hollywood we know that that isn't always so, is really extraordinary.
It's so funny because I'm like, oh, I have a job. I'll just do my job. Like, you know, I'm given an opportunity. I'll just figure out how to do it. And I do think that there was a lot of, like, being thrown at me in the beginning. oh, you're a natural, like you were made for this. And that didn't really compute. I didn't really understand what it meant. And only after a while, you know, actually I was filming one day before we started production on the show, we were still in pre-production, but I did a little one day video with my friend Daniel Klein, who has the perennial plate. Mm-hmm. And he was like, Samin, I always forget, you're such a natural. And I was like, Daniel, everyone keeps saying that. What does it mean? And he said, it's just because you're the same when the cameras are on and when the cameras are off. And there's some way where it doesn't phase you. And that's really rare. And I was like, it is? You know, because to me, I was like, why would I change if there's cameras there? It just didn't even occur to me to change. And so I guess that's a special skill. And then, you know, there were a lot of other things that I learned throughout the process. It was definitely like immersive learning. But there are a lot of things that are very similar to TV production from cooking, from working in a restaurant, you know? And it felt very second nature to me in a lot of ways.
The show, the first episode is on fat, not salt, which surprised me. And I was just shocked that it was Italy, that the fat you chose was olive oil. And the context of that was the food culture of Italy. That was fascinating to me.
Well, you know, the beauty of this idea is that it's universal. And so we went through so many different countries trying to piece together a production, you know, based on schedule and budget and who we knew where, but also based on my story. And since the beginning, I had always associated Italy with fat because of the olive oil and because it was really where I learned about olive oil. And also I worked with Dario Cecchini, the butcher, and that was where I learned, you know, I learned a lot about pork fat there. At one point, we considered Italy for salt, to go to Sicily and do like the trapanese salt and anchovies and capers, but just scheduling-wise, it didn't work out. And so I was really happy to do olive oil. It's such a sort of foundational fat for me in my cooking. And I think for a lot of people, there's a lot to learn about it. So I was really pleased to do that. And in terms of putting it first, that wasn't, that was Netflix. They just were, I think they loved that episode so much.
Yeah, it's visually stunning. And also the fact that the light hasn't been shown on Liguria like it has been on Tuscany or Lazio, where Rome is, for example.
Yeah. And again, like Ligurian olive oil has always been my favorite. So to me, I knew I wanted, I was like, I want to do this. It was very fun in a lot of ways. I was like, if we're going to Italy, we have to do Parmesan cheese. We have to do Ligurian olive oil. We have to do a butcher in Tuscany, you know.
And did you say, and I have to be able to speak in Italian? Because within the first few minutes, I'm like listening to you speak Italian and I'm reading the subtitles and I keep waiting for it to switch over and it doesn't. There was something about sort of your naturalness and the authenticity of that that I found very synergistic.
What was funny was I don't think we planned to do it in Italian. It had been 13 years since I'd been to Italy. So I was surprised by how much I remembered. You know, I try to watch movies in Italian. I still, you know, visit with Dario when he comes and he doesn't speak a word of English. So I've had like maybe 3 times a year I practice speaking my Italian. I was really surprised how much I remembered, but we immediately landed and it just came back to me. And once I started doing it, they were like, yeah, let's go with this. I mean, I think there was a lot that we were figuring out as we went along, and that was just one of the first things. But yeah, it didn't make sense not to. I mean, yeah. It's also a lot faster because then a translator, yeah, I don't have to wait for a translator, and then the scene keeps going. Like, we don't start and stop, and it lets everybody be more natural if I can just speak to them.
But you toured Japan, and that's all about salt. Talk to me about your relationship with that country and its food. Was that also an obvious decision?
In my mind, so originally in the very first, like, sort of treatments that we were making and envisioning the show, I wanted to go to multiple countries per episode because, again, to prove the point that wherever you go, these things keep showing up. So I really wanted to go to Bolivia to visit those huge salt flats there. And I also wanted to go to Japan to demonstrate, oh, this is a culture that uses salt in all of these different ways, every single day, every single dish. But I had never been to Japan. I don't really know anything about Japanese cooking. I have many friends. There's kind of a beautiful sisterhood between a group of Japanese chefs and a group of Bay Area chefs. So we've had an exchange going on for many years, and I knew Yuri through that, and I knew a bunch of other folks in Japan through that. But it was definitely one where I was like, teach me everything, because I don't know anything about this. And yeah.
So I have to ask you sort of a bizarre side question here. There's a yellow pot, which makes an appearance at Nancy Hachisu's house outside of Tokyo. And that pot reappears with your mother in the last episode at your house.
I know, it's so funny. So so many people have commented. They're like, did you travel with this pot across an ocean? We happen to have the same pot. It's those Dansk Coben style like pots. I got mine on eBay, and Nancy, I think, you know, got hers 30 years ago. And so many people are like, where'd you get that pot? It's amazing. And I'm like, you can buy them on Amazon or eBay.
I have to tell you that I grew up with one of those pots, and never did I see my mother use the lid as a trivet.
I can't believe
that this is how I'm learning about it. Throughout the show, you're constantly asking questions of people. But when I was watching the Japan episode, I thought to myself, were these questions scripted or did you literally not know? And so you just were asking questions wherever you were.
I'm always asking questions. So that's definitely part of it. Caroline Soo, my director, is a really avid eater. She's of Korean descent. And the Korean word for like someone who likes to eat is mokpo. And the Farsi word for someone who likes to eat is shekamu. So those are like nicknames for each other. But she's not a professional cook. You know, she's not a food professional. So she had a lot of sort of layperson questions. And she was really good at feeding them to me. But there were a lot where I didn't know, you know, especially in Japan and in the Yucatan, there were a lot of things I didn't actually know. And also I understood that it's my job to sit in, you know, to stand in for the viewer and ask the questions that they might not know. And one thing I had, I'm definitely on like a human journey still, but, you know, I grew up in a family and in a culture and in a time where to me, to admit that I didn't know something was really embarrassing, right? Because I wanted to prove how smart and special I was. I've kind of come around, and now I'm okay with being like, what's that? Or the other day I was in an interview with somebody really like intellectual, and he used a word I didn't know, and I was like, I don't know what that means. You have to define it for me. So I'm getting better at just being like, I don't know what that thing is. Teach me. And I feel like that's a thing you don't get to see a lot on TV. And I feel like if I can be a little bit fearless and not worried about being embarrassed, then maybe that will help you be a little bit more fearless and not worried about being embarrassed.
The other part of the show, which is extraordinary, is the focus that you put on women and the way they come into the show as a host or a chef or a nonna. And this idea of women in the foreground, was that intentional?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I also think it has to be intentional in a world where the natural pull of the media is not toward home cooks or toward women. And so precisely because of that, I made it our mission. Again, from the very first treatments, going back and forth with Jigsaw, the production company, I was constantly like course correcting. And then eventually we all got on the same page and they were like, oh, some of you won't like this, which was great. You know, like that they understood. And it didn't take a lot for me to convince anyone why I wanted to do it. I think it's just a thing I've been paying attention to, you know, the food landscape and food media for a long time. And I have been acutely aware of what's missing. And I felt very strongly like this might be my only shot. So what do I want to do with it? You know, I want to make something different.
Let's talk about the Yucatan. Every single episode had its own super engaging beauty. And that, of course, was all about acid. It was just blew my mind. The honey thing blew my mind.
The honey is crazy. I mean, obviously, I knew it was more acidic. You know, going there, I was like, oh, I'm going to taste this honey that's more acidic. It was completely genuine, like the expression on my face, the reaction I had to tasting it, which was, I mean, it tastes like honey lemonade. It's this Melipona honey that comes from these Melipona bees, which are a really ancient kind of stingerless bee that for, I think, 3,000 years, these bees have had a relationship with the people of the Yucatan because since they don't have stingers, they don't have natural defenses. So they really rely on humans. It's a symbiotic relationship. And the humans protect them from predators and help them build these hives that have all these like mazes and all these other defense mechanisms that are, you know, not stingers. And then the humans get this honey, which has all of these incredible characteristics, like some which I think have been assigned and some which are natural, things like maybe it's a little bit more antibacterial, it's a little bit medicinal, has like almost mystical characteristics.
And is sometimes transparent.
Oh, it's very light in color. It's very, very light in color, and it's very thin. And, I mean, on the show, you see they harvest it with a syringe, like because a typical beehive produces anywhere from 20 to 30 liters a year, I think, and a Melipona hive has 1 to 2. And so it's very precious and hence very expensive. I was really excited. We found this community through our food producer, this incredible woman, Nikki Nakazawa, who has had a pop-up in Mexico for 10 years, and she had worked with Rene Redzepi when he was there, like helping source mezcals, and she had worked on Dave Chang's Ugly Delicious episode down there. And so she connected us to this organization, the Tres Patio Maya. They are just doing this incredible work to support indigenous populations. And so for me, it was a great opportunity to taste this incredible thing, but also to highlight these people who have historically been so disenfranchised. And in doing so, hopefully get them some attention and some money, you know, like maybe we can create a market for this honey for them.
And also all those Seville oranges.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to say that watching that episode made me want to have in our market, you know, come on.
You have everything.
We have everything. And yet, so it's so brief.
Mm-hmm.
It's brief and rare that we get sour oranges.
Yeah, we get them in Northern California for about maybe 6 weeks, like December to early February.
Yeah.
And
if your show could just make that a bit more diffuse.
Yeah. I mean, already I've gotten messages from people. I have a friend who's like, I want to start a company that harvests all of the sort of fallen fruit from the sour orange trees and creates sour orange juice, you know, products. And I was like, do it. I was like, you now have a global market for it.
The women that you were cooking with down there in the Yucatan were so generous and patient. The scene where you're making the tortillas.
Oh my God, they were going to kill me. They were not having it. I mean, they were amazing. So that family, they live still in the like pre-colonial way. They live on a milpa, you know, and they grow their three sisters. And this mother, her brood all lives on this piece of land with her in these tiny little like huts, basically. Typically, she grinds her own corn every day, but her mill was down. And so that was why we went down to the like town Molino. But yeah, they were very not impressed by me or the production or like my lack of tortilla skills or the fact that I just kept cracking up.
When you asked her how many tortillas she made a day, 240.
Yeah, 250 or something a day. Like she just, because she has to feed all these. There's like 17 or 18 people who live there. And over the course of a day, each one will eat 10 tortillas, you know. And she just was like, you're some chef coming from some other country and you can't even make one tortilla, right? You know? She was not impressed.
So that laugh, we hear it a lot in the show, sometimes with tears at the same time, like the habanero salsa.
Oh my God, it was so spicy. You know, and that's a whole other thing that was so funny was became a joke on the show, like what a terrible actress I am. I can't fake anything skills. And so if we knew that I needed to be surprised by something or have a hello, like a genuine hello with somebody for the first time, they learned pretty quickly that they had to segregate me, you know, and so that, like keep me separate to make sure that we could capture the original hello because I wasn't going to be able to redo it 10 times because I just don't have it in me. And so there was also, so that's one part of it is like I'm a terrible actress. And part of it is I just have this mind that's going on all the levels at once. So I'm doing the thing, I'm doing whatever I'm doing for the camera. as a storyteller and a journalist, I'm thinking, like, is this making a good story for the audience? And then also I'm very aware that there's all of these people here and this, like, you know, 20 people standing and looking and the multiple cameras and directors and producers and all this kind of stuff. And so I was having a very meta experience going into the salsa because I could tell just as they were making it, the entire space, it was kind of this covered market. We were all weeping because it was so spicy. We couldn't really even breathe. We were all coughing. And I knew it was going to be spicy. So I took a bite and it was this thing where I took a bite and it was so incredibly spicy that tears came to my eyes. And I'm having this like calculation in my head, like I'm being recorded. There's tears coming in my eyes. I'm wearing a little bit of eye makeup. And like, I also know I'm going to still have to eat 10 more bites of this most spiciest thing that I've ever eaten in my life. So I'm like, I'm just cracking up at the absurdity of it all, you know? You know, and I'm like dropping my tissues and like it's just, and I'm like, well, this is good TV at least.
Well, it's good TV because they decided to leave it in.
Yeah, totally.
So a couple times throughout the show, the concept of wabi-sabi is mentioned. Talk to me about what that means.
Man, I should have done my homework. Okay, so what I believe it means is sort of the imperfection of humanity. You know, I think a lot of different cultures have this idea. I know in some Native American cultures, there's even like, there'll be a weaving, and on the last like rung of the weaving, they'll do it imperfectly on purpose because the only gods and only, you know, the perfect deities make things perfect. And so I had heard about it in the one example that I had heard about in Japan was of this master ceramicist who's been doing ceramics for like 60 years and can pick up a lump of clay and pull a bowl in like two movements and it'll be perfect. And then he'll always just do a little tap to make sure that, you know, he's put his human touch on it. And I love that because to me, there's nothing that I do that's perfect, you know, and like there's kind of, and yet I'm a perfectionist always striving for that. So it's kind of a little bit of a relief for me to be like, well, there's beauty in the, you know, in the flower arrangement with the like fallen leaf.
But what I think is interesting that you say you're perfectionist, in the result of your work, in the flavor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there's many, like they say, there's many roads that lead to Rome.
Yeah.
And that's sort of your whole way of teaching.
Yeah, for sure. I'm after like that deepest, farthest, like most delicious flavor, but there's so many ways to get there. And that's exactly right. And I'm always trying to show you that whatever, you can always make do with whatever you've got to get there. Also, as I've gotten deeper into the food world and deeper into cooking, for me, the food matters so much less. And so it's the experience of going to the market and bumping into people, or it's the experience of bringing a whole bunch of kids into my kitchen and they're tearing everything apart. But like, I get this really fun day with them, and it's okay if the pasta we make is really ugly and half uncooked because it's kind of like uneven, because what did we get out of that? We got this amazing experience. And so I think my own values have shifted away from that product and more into the experience. And my hope is that that's really conveyed through the work.
Definitely. I have to tell you that yesterday, I mean, I was having like this really weird day of jet lag eating, which is just like a bunch of very disparate things sequentially.
I'm familiar.
And I was roasting a bunch of asparagus. And I put it in my little toaster oven, and I had the heads in first. And then I thought to myself, no, Samin was talking about how she puts the legs of a chicken to the back of the oven. And I said, well, this would be the same.
Totally.
For the bottoms of the asparagus or the tops of whole roasted carrots.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me such joy to experience this exchange between the two of us, even though you weren't there, from just something that you talked about.
I love that so much. I mean, when I was making the book, my friend Tamar Adler's book had come out a few years earlier, and I had so many friends, including myself, who read and loved that book. And there was a lot of like, what would Tamar do? Or Tamar would tell me to do this. And so that became this thing that I aspired to do and to be, was your friend in the kitchen. If I could be so clear in my voice in the book that you could know what I would advise you to do. If I'm going to be the little, like, Jiminy Cricket, or my friend calls me Samini Cricket.
And that's, I don't think people understand how hard that is to do.
Yeah. And so that I feel like the show just helps that go to a whole other level. In fact, yesterday, another friend texted me, he said, oh, my husband's putting on the pasta water to boil. And he looked at me and he's like, well, Samin would probably say add 2 cups of salt now. I wrote back, I was like, maybe 3.
Yes, so you and your mom. You and your mom, what a fascinating juxtaposition.
Oh, my gosh.
Not just temperamentally.
In every way.
In every way.
And then I'm going to put some saffron in.
The saffron is going to start giving some color and taste and smell to the tahdig. We try to make it into a heap. Then the steam is going to come from around it, and it's going to be easier to cook.
And then this is my favorite part. Got to poke the holes all the way down to the bottom.
We let the steam come up.
So it's really just such a mild little sizzle in there.
Yes.
It's not very strong.
Not at all.
Apparently I've been doing this wrong my whole life.
You're not frying it. You're just making good crusty tahdig.
Okay.
What I loved about that segment was everything that was unsaid.
There was so much tongue biting.
For many of us who have mothers who are very opinionated.
And it was really funny, too, because there was this one moment where she was amazing on camera. And I knew.
So calm collected. Yeah.
And I knew it would be a great scene. I just was like, oh, this is emotional seppuku. Like, I was I knew what I was going. I was like, I will sacrifice my own self for this thing. And so we brought her, and she was great. And yet, like, she, you know, like, our family's been going through some stuff in the past few years. Like, also, no kids live at home, so she's not making rice every day. You know, it's not, she's a little out of practice. And so she put the rice on, and, like, she put it on so low. And I was like, Mom, are you sure it's supposed to be this low? And I kept trying to hint, like, let's turn it up a little. Let's turn it up a little. And she's like, no, it has to be really, really, really low. And then in the end, it was too low, and we actually had to put it back in the pot. And we were running out of daylight, and it was this whole thing. And so when we went to go flip it out, I could tell it wasn't as, like, tight as it could have or should have been. And so we flipped it out, and a little piece of it broke. And I immediately, you know, again, I had that thought, that production head, where I'm like, well, we're not going to be able to do it again. Like, this is it, you know, and this thing. But even in that moment, I was like, well, sometimes it breaks, you know? Like,
the tahdig.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, that the crispy rice. And, I mean, because one knows watching that segment that you learned all that from her. And probably once you already knew it really well, maybe better than her, she still had to coach you.
Oh, 100%.
A million times and tell you what you were doing wrong.
Totally. I mean, yeah. And people are always like, oh, you guys must have such a fun time cooking together. I was like, no, she just cooks. Like, I can't put myself through the turmoil of cooking in the kitchen with her. And she can cook way more delicious Persian food than I can, you know? And it's the taste of my childhood. It's what it's like gives her pleasure to cook for me, and it gives me pleasure to not have to cook with her.
So the heat episode, which takes place, part of it takes place at Chez Panisse, where you began your cooking career. And there's a great scene where you're grilling steaks over coal fire with head chef Amy Densler. Again, this totally refreshing visual to see you and a woman of a certain age, not a youngster, running the kitchen. And in so many food shows where there is fire and meat involved, it's usually a couple bearded men in plaid shirts. Was that typical of being at Chez Panisse, the female?
Absolutely. And also, I really did learn how to grill steak from Amy Densler. So to me, I was like, oh, we're going there. We're going to do this, you know. And obviously, somewhere in the back of my mind, I understood what a subversive kind of image it is to put that on TV. But I think for me, the watching women and coming up alongside women in the kitchen who are incredibly skilled has been one of the great privileges and joys of my cooking career, to see girls not being afraid of fire, not only not being afraid of it, but like being able to control it And I am very clear that I'm not the best chef in the world or even the best cook. And there are so many women in my community and men who are way better cooks than I am. And so it's a dream for me to get to let the world see that, you know. And Amy Densler is one of the most elegant, soft-spoken, talented, and under-recognized cooks in this country. And to give her like 3 minutes of airtime was a great pleasure. You know, she's like a big, she was like a big sister to me in the kitchen. And in what was never a very like macho kitchen, but obviously for a 19-year-old was a really intimidating place to be. She always made space for me. And so this was a way for me to honor her.
And I just want to talk for a minute about, because we're talking about like women and strength in a certain way. One of the things that I love the most in the show is that sprinkled throughout these visits to destinations, there are instructional parts that take place in your home. And
or my quote-unquote home.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yes, your quote-unquote home. Somebody's beautiful home.
Yeah.
And your hands, the image of watching you make food, I think... The scars.
So many scars, yeah.
And I just think it's, it was very meaningful to me.
Thank you.
I'm tearing up.
No, thank you. Multiple people have mentioned that. And I think I love my hands. You know, I love the scars. Like, they all tell a different story. And I remember, like, they all mean something in my birthmark and...
But it's also the competency, because so many, whenever people talk about like minimum wage or immigrant issues, they always refer to unskilled labor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we do in the kitchen, even, it is so skilled once you achieve a facility.
Absolutely.
And so to watch you just transform things with your hand in a very sure way is really wonderful.
Thank you. That's really nice to hear. I mean, yeah, I don't know what else to say. I feel sometimes, also it's this, I'm going through my own weird, I'm in a weird position and transformation.
What is it? I was going to ask you, and, so what are you going to do next? Do you immediately go to season two? Or are you going to write another book where you invent four other flavors?
I need a rest. That's like the first thing I know I need to do is like, I've been sprinting salt, fat, acid, heat for 6 years. So I need a break. I need to figure out, I need to make choices from a place of clarity rather than like, because it's also amazing because everyone's like, I got an email the other day. I was like, come to Transylvania. I was like, I got to go to Transylvania. Like, you know, like, and I was like.
They make good salami there.
I know. I mean, all these amazing opportunities, but I also know myself and like, I will run myself ragged. So I'm going to take a break and I need to figure out sort of what's going to bring me the most joy. I feel like the amazing thing that I've broken through something is now I just get to do whatever I want, which is pretty lucky and pretty cool. So that's pretty awesome. But I guess in terms of the transformation that are like this weird transition that I'm referring to is I'm not exactly, it's been a lot of years since I was in a kitchen every day, but I still, if people ask me what I do, I always say cook first, even though I go to an office and I write most days. So some days I say writer, but also, I don't know, now I have this other thing that I do. And I'm just trying to figure out who I am. So a lot of the time I feel very unsure as a cook, especially anytime I do sort of moonlight with other people. I'm always like, do I remember how to make ravioli? The other day I had to make something. I was making caramels. And I was like, I don't even know. You know, a recipe I've made a bajillion times. And I somehow ruined it. And I was like, well, there you go. Like,
I call myself a culinary multitasker.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah.
You're allowed to use
that. Okay, thanks.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's just a dream and an honor and a pleasure to sit here with you, Evan.
That's chef, teacher, and author Samin Nosrat. Her James Beard-winning show Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat is streaming now on Netflix. After the break, a remarkable book on the subject of cooking goat that won the James Beard Award for Best Single Subject Book. That and more when we return. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman.
You can't justify essentially knocking these animals on the head and chucking them in the bin when they're perfectly viable animals. On a fundamental level, that felt really wrong to me.
Each year in the UK, tens of thousands of baby male goats are killed at birth because dairy farmers can't afford to keep them. That's where English chef and farmer James Wetlore saw a solution. In 2012, he founded Cabrito, a company that supplies fine restaurants and retailers with goat meat. James says that not only is goat delicious, it's healthy and sustainable too. You began your career as a chef in London before turning to farming. What prompted you to take another path?
We had a small piece of land. It was really overgrown. So we wanted to put pigs on it, but the next door neighbours didn't want us to have pigs. So we thought, you know, the sort of stereotypical idea of goats is they eat anything and they're really good at clearing land. So we thought we'd put that theory to the test. And we got four goats from a small dairy that was quite local to us. And the guy that sold us the goats became a friend and is still a friend now. But he was running a small dairy with 120 milking nannies. And obviously he had a lot of billies that he didn't have any use for because he was making cheese. And my background in cooking made me think, well, the London restaurant scene is massive. And I thought that I knew that restaurant scene really well. So maybe I could help Will out, the guy that had given us these first four goats, by getting rid of the excess billies he had. And I thought maybe it'd pay for a holiday or be a bit of extra cash. And we had no idea that, you know, within 18 months I would quit my job and started traveling the country trying to find goat dairies that would sell me their billy goats. And now, 6 years on, we take about 30% of all the billy goats born in the UK, which is up from almost zero.
So let's back up a bit. You know, a lot of people who consume food don't really have any sense of the arc of seasonality or what goes on. So in order to make goat cheese, obviously you need to milk a lot of goats. Also, you need to have a fair number of goats that are getting pregnant. So what happens every spring when kidding happens, when there's just this onslaught of newborn baby goats?
Yeah, you've put your finger on it there, because we all kind of understand the basic biology behind it, but we don't make the link with the dairy production, which, and obviously you need pregnant females in order to get lactation, and the pregnancy has consequences. And in this case, it's billy goats, and the nannies will usually have two goats, as they'll have twins. And obviously nature decrees there's a 50-50 split in the sexes of those, which means 50% of the billy goats born, or 50% of the goats born on the farm, will not be required by the dairy industry. And that means that those animals are essentially useless in the farmer's eyes, because in the UK we don't have a cultural history of eating goat, and in the US, certainly among the majority of the population, there's no sort of history of eating goat. And that means that you can't expect a farmer to rear an animal that will cost it the best part of £100. I'm not quite sure of the costings in the US, but it wouldn't cost less than $100, I'd imagine, to rear an animal that it doesn't have a market to sell. So in an overwhelming majority of cases, they are euthanized at birth, which, I mean, it's just completely... I mean, I've been doing this for 6 years and I still can't get my head around how you're allowed to do it.
Now that we have sort of that overview, let's go way back in time and sort of talk about the economic decisions in medieval England that sort of determined goats' lack of use in the food and farming culture.
In the UK, we started exporting a lot of wool in about the 12th century. And the thing about wool is that it's really light, but it was really valuable, which makes it almost the perfect thing to export, because you can fill a horse-drawn wagon with it, and you can pile loads in and the horse can pull it along, but there's loads of value in that. It's not like really heavy metals or, you know, gold or glass and things that are quite hard to transport. Wool is easy to transport. So it was almost the perfect product to build an economy on. And that's what happened in the early medieval times. It turned into monopoly capitalism. Any farmer that had any land at all would choose to have a sheep, because it was a three-value item. You had the meat and the milk, which a goat would give you, but you had the fleece from a sheep, which was worth more than the milk and the meat put together. So you had this situation where anyone with any land would choose to have sheep over goats. And that meant that goats were marginalised. They were only kept by people that didn't have enough land to keep sheep. So they became the animal of the poor, whereas sheep became the animal of the rich. So if you fast forward from sort of early 1300s, you get to a point where literacy starts to enter society. But the only people that can read and write are rich, and they're not eating goat. They're eating sheep. So they are preserving in the recipe record and writing down the first cookbook in the English language, called A Form of a Curry, which was written for the court of Richard II in 1387. Sorry, there's one goat recipe in it. It's called The Form of a Curry. And that recipe keeps repeating for 600 years and is completely unchanged. The same cookbook's got about 40 sheep recipes in it. There aren't any goats in any kind of numbers in the UK until the early 1980s when we started copying what the French did and making goat's cheese.
So I'm curious, the goats that you're finding a market for, because really that's what your business is all about. Your business is about finding a market for protein that would be thrown away.
Correct.
What kind of chefs and cooks are buying it and what are they doing with it?
There is as many different styles of food as people we supply. I mean, we supply Yota Motolenghi's restaurants. There are so many different types, it's difficult to put your finger on just one, but everybody's doing something different and nobody's just fallen back on the sort of, oh, you've got to slow cook it or you've got to curry it trope. Everyone has been quite adventurous with it. And yes, it's difficult to say that there is sort of one overriding thing because everybody's doing such different things with it, which is great because it shows the versatility of it.
And is there more demand than you have supply?
No, sadly, there isn't.
And my second question to that would be, do they want them really young or are some chefs asking that they be allowed to grow out a bit and get older?
One of the main innovations of Cabrito is that we take our animals up to about 6-7 months old. So they're about 22 kilos dead weight, which is similar to a lamb. So when we first started, we tried to replicate what is imported from Spain and France, and they're sort of 12 kilos. And there isn't a lot you can do with a 12 kilo carcass. I mean, you've eaten hare and rabbit and stuff. It felt like that. Whereas if you grow them to the size that we have, then they look like a lamb on the counter or on the hook. And it means that chefs and the buying public in butchers have more options. And they understand it better because it looks familiar.
Give me some quick ways of cooking goat, things that aren't, as you said before, the long, slow braises.
Well, my favorite way of eating it is kebanya, which is the Syrian national dish. And it is the sort of a Middle East version of a tartare. So it's raw. So you take the loins or a sort of a good piece of leg meat that's got no sinew in it and hand chop it until it's really fine. And then equal amounts of that hand-chopped meat with cooked bulgur wheat. And then you just put in a load of herbs like mint and parsley and thyme and lemon juice and olive oil. Then you mix it all together. That's one of my favourites. One of my other favourites is just on a barbecue, quite a hot barbecue. If you bone a leg, but you marinate it in for a few hours in preserved lemon and rosemary and garlic and loads of sea salt and give it a good rub with that and leave it somewhere for a couple of hours. And then get your barbecue nice and hot and just flash grill it on the barbecue. And don't rest it for too long because the meat is really lean. If you rest it for too long, it doesn't have the fat in the muscle to retain the moisture like beef and lamb does. So don't rest it for too long. Slice it nice and thin. And that is amazing. Something about goat, fire, and lemon, which, it's just off the scale.
Well, thank you so much. It's quite impressive what you're doing and really interesting.
Thank you.
That's chef and farmer James Wetlore. His book, Goat, Cooking and Eating, picked up a James Beard Award for Best Single Subject Book last month. Now we close out the show with a new restaurant recommendation from LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega. Where are we going?
So today we're headed to Orange County, specifically Anaheim, and we're going to eat at Fonda Miscuac. A fonda is a little less formal than a restaurant. It's kind of a cafe, I would say, Mexican cafe.
I hear that we're going to hack our way through the meal with a machete.
That's correct. So the headline to this review, which shout out to one of our copy editors, is at Fonda Miscuac in Anaheim, order a cheesy 29-inch machete, bring friends. So the emphasis here is on bring friends.
Is it a masa-based dish?
Yeah, so the easiest way to describe a machete, it's a corn tortilla, corn masa quesadilla, but it's been shaped into like this long machete shape, folded over, filled with large amounts of meats, cheeses, condiments. I would say it's as fun to eat and as customizable as a pizza.
Was there one on every single table?
There pretty much is one at every single table. And if you can't handle the 29-inch machete, they also make a 12-inch machetito, kind of a junior size, which is still quite large. So just a heads up.
But there are many other things on the menu. One of my favorite Mexican sandwiches is the pambazo.
Ah, yes. So if you're a fan of the pambazo, Fonda Miscuac makes a really great one. It's a chili-stained French roll stuffed with chorizo and potato and just like a little sprinkling of queso fresco. Super good. One of my favorite pambazos I've had so far in Southern California.
Who's the family running this fonda?
It's a very large family. There's 9 siblings. The father is Jose Villegas, and he recently suffered a heart attack. So the 2 youngest sons are kind of the face of the restaurant right now while he recovers. And the whole family, really, you'll see them kind of trade off kitchen duties. So you may see different faces behind the counter. A really friendly, large family.
One of my favorite quotes in the article was from Jose's son, Eric, who said, my dad always says that if you want Mexican food, go to Taco Bell. But if you want comida mexicana, come here.
That's right. I love that line. And you'll note on the cover of their menu, they have the phrase comida mexicana printed in all caps. He told me, yeah, his dad takes his food very seriously. The restaurant, the name Miscuac, refers to a part of southern Mexico City that is known for just really great tacos. Jose Villegas is a native of Mexico City, so he really wanted his restaurant to just connote how seriously he takes his Mexico City food.
They also have another dish I really love, which is alambres.
I love alambres too, Evan. So it's this platter of beef. So the beef has been chopped up and it's kind of glued together by melted Oaxaca cheese. And it has bits of ham and bits of bacon. I love the way they serve it at Fonda Miscuac. They have a stack of hot tortillas that they layer over the top. So you just dig in with the tortilla and kind of make your own impromptu taco party.
Thank you so much for telling us about it.
Oh, thank you, Evan. Thank you for having me.
I've been talking with LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega about Fonda Miscuac in Anaheim. Visit the Good Food website for a link to our LA Times review. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. That is it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, leave us a review if you liked what you heard. My thanks to the Good Food team. They are Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Laura Kondarajan. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.